Good morning, everyone. A year ago, my husband Bob was standing up here giving a talk for this same occasion. He had always said that he intended to live in our El Cerrito home until he was carried out feet first. That happened last September. I said, if Bob died first, I would not remain alone in our 6-bedroom, 4-bath house where we raised 4 kids. As Bob's health deteriorated in the summer, and I realized that within the coming year, Bob might leave, I decided to make the double bedroom and bath at the lower part of the house available to a Star King student. Nancy Taylor joined us in August. Bob departed mid-September. That evening, we had enjoyed eating mint chocolate ice cream with cream de menthe over the top. We didn't realize it would be our last meal together. About 6 hours later, I was glad Nancy was with me as Bob was dying, because our nearest son and his wife in Montera and the hospice nurse hadn't had time to arrive. Now I enjoy having Nancy in the house and sharing coffee together in the mornings. Also, no words can express the deep gratitude I feel toward our ministers and members of this church for the support and hugs received during those early dark days, and I'm still receiving. Soon after Bob died, I had a dream which took me back to my early childhood to a farm in Kansas. I remembered a team of horses my dad had called Tommy and Barney. Dad was fond of that team who worked the fields along with 6 mules. In the winter, when the horses were in their stalls in the barn, I remember petting their faces. The skin around their nostrils was soft like velvet, and I got to feed them sometimes their ration of oats, which they really liked. I was 6 when Tommy died. My father sold the mules, bought his first tractor, and kept Barney for small jobs like plowing my mother's garden. It was hard for Barney, but he managed to pull the load alone. That was what I would have to do without Bob, pull the load alone. The theme this month is creativity. To me, that means doing something which puts one on a higher level of consciousness. On one level, I had to become more creative in managing things I had always depended on Bob doing. For the first time, I put gas in my car. I balanced the checkbook and took care of financial details I never did before. I realize how much I depended on this man I cared about for over 65 years. Like Tommy and Barney, we were a good team together, the scientist and the teacher, both pulling our load. But being creative inspires one emotionally as well. For me, that's centered around doing 2 things, gardening and creative writing. After the death of our firstborn son, I found solace working in my garden and learning to be thankful that we had had him for 45 years. My goal was to have cut flowers year-round because every time I look at a perfect bloom, I feel good about helping to create such beauty. It's like I'm connected to a greater power. Creative writing helps to elevate me also. I'm not leaving behind quilts for my grandchildren as my mother and grandmother did, but books about life as I know it. I published a book about our ancestry and tried to go beyond birth and death dates and put flesh on the bones of our ancestors with family stories and other information. My second book was called Cornfields, Memoirs of a Kansas Farm Girl. My kids didn't want either book sold on Amazon for identity reasons. I gave copies to friends and made some available at the book table here at church. Currently, I'm working on a book about travels with Bob based on our many trips together, which will be on Amazon. I have set my new goal to publish it by the end of my 86th year. Originally, it was my 85th, but I'm having a birthday in 3 days, and I have too many distractions this past year for that deadline. Once I complete that book, my goal will be to declutter the house in anticipation of my own death. That task may take years. In conclusion, I find that having a reason to get out of bed every morning with goals to accomplish helps me to live my life more creatively.
Thank you. I want to invite forward Frederick Shaw, also someone who needs very little introduction. Many of us know him here by his absences when he's been in India for months at a time doing his work there. We're always eager to see him come back. He's been around with us more lately, sharing in choir and in so many ways in our work in social justice. I invite forward Frederick Shaw now to give his reflection.
I am honored to speak before you this morning. I suppose most of you know to your cost that when an Irish man is invited to speak, it's like asking an alcoholic, would you like a drink? The theme that I've been given is creativity. And I think the first time that I heard this word, I was about 6-year-old. And I was eavesdropping my mother and father having a conversation about me. And I had no idea what creativity meant. But it happened, this conversation in which creativity is being attached to me, immediately followed conversation I had with my father about my cricket ball, which seems to have had some minor accident with a window in the garage. And this happened coincidentally while I was in the garden. So I still had thoughts about, you know, what's creativity got to do with that? But I think it may have something to do with what I was saying. Several years later, I learned that the dictionary meaning of creativity was that it was the act of creating or making something where nothing had been there in the past. And so years later again, I became involved in what was to be my second and longest, career, which was international development, some 45 years there. And in thinking about it and thinking about the past years and all the things that have happened in this career, I think creativity is the single biggest factor that I can see common throughout the whole time. In my first experiences, I was employed by CARE, and there I left immediately for Calcutta and spent 2 years in North India, and then 2 years in South India in Kerala. And from there, I went to Philippines for 3 years. Those 7 years, if they taught me anything, it was that the single biggest problems that existed in the developing world were problems of health. And I had no background in this, so I came back to the United States and for the next 5 years spent in graduate school earning a doctorate in public health. I then went back overseas, initially to Pakistan, and then Swaziland, and on. And I was concerned with what is happening in these development projects that the development agencies are conducting. Because although the projects are conducted well, I had yet to see one that had any lasting effect. And so what would happen, even with CARE, which is one of the most ethical and successful agencies I know, they would conduct a project. Suppose it lasted 3-4 years and would cost $5-6 million. And then the experts that did the project, which is designed to make improvements, lasting improvements, would go back home to wherever their developed country was. And within a year, the advancements, the improvements that were made in the developing country had disappeared. There's no sign that they were ever there. They did some good while they were being conducted, but in terms of lasting impact, it simply wasn't there. And this type of thing had been going so long, I suppose development really got impetus after Second World War. This had been going on so long that the agencies had come to think of this as normal. You go overseas and you do a project and you spend a lot of money and then you come back home. And then in a year or two, back in the developed countries, things go back to where they were before you went. And I struggled with this and tried to understand why was this happening. And one of the reasons that came to mind was that when the experts went overseas, they did their thing, and many were very successful in doing important things, increasing common incomes, reducing health risks, providing immunizations, doing all kinds of profitable and proper things that helped the local people. But none of these stayed. And of course, that was our aim, that we should improve conditions and they should stay improved, that people would go on and keep the project activities alive. And so I looked at, well, how did the developed countries get the way they were? How did it happen? Did someone come from overseas? There wasn't anybody to come from overseas to developing countries. So how did they get this way? And in looking at things and a quick review of world history, I came to the decision that the way we happily are now, or almost happily are, is through a process of like Darwinian social evolution, where ideas came along about how we should live, how our governments should be, how our housing should be, how our medicine should be, how our employment should be, how our conditions should be. We're a Darwinian evolution type of thing. And I thought, is this the only way it can occur in the developing, so-called developing world? People who were looking at this situation closely, as I was seeing that developing countries didn't exist. These countries weren't developing. We are pouring billions, trillions of dollars since Second World War. But let's count the countries that became developed. You know how many? Well, I don't think we'd spend a lot of time counting. So what was the difference between the result of evolution and the result of our 3 or 4 year projects? The evolution was successful, and our projects in long-term terms wasn't. So what was the difference? And when I looked at this, I thought the biggest single difference that I can see, well, of course, one is short-term and one is long-term, that's there. But apart from that, the biggest single difference was that the experts came to a so-called developing country, did their thing, and went home. And in the evolutionary process, the people involved in the process stayed there. They didn't go anywhere. So in the last stages of or phases of development that the people reached when there was a change due, the people who brought about the change, this last single change, stayed there. And so I thought, well, why don't we'll conduct a project and then we'll have the experts stay there. When I proposed this to some friends and we talked about it and we looked at budgets, this was not possible. This was not practical. This would make, if we had the experts stay there, this would cost so much that we couldn't get funding for the projects. So I thought of a lot of other things. And then I wondered, suppose that the people who had the problem, who needed to improve the quality of life in their areas, suppose those were the people who conducted the program, the project. So I talked to my friends about this, and I talked to other people in development and people who ran agencies, and nobody bought this one. They said these experts that go in and do this work have all got PhDs and all kinds of nice things and all kinds of expertise. And you're talking about local people, most of whom haven't gone to school, even elementary school. You're talking about those people doing a project? And I had admitted, yes, I was. And nobody bought it. I couldn't get anybody to have anything to do with me or this stupid idea. So I did the only thing that was possible. I started my own development agencies called Developing Indigenous Resources. And many people in this congregation are connected to that organization. And several of our board members are still board members. And Bob Sayre, that you just heard of and from Winnie a few minutes ago, was a board member of DIR. And the first money that I got to start this organization came from friends in this congregation. So it was a big connection there, a deep connection between this church and DIR and my new corporation. It was founded as a California nonprofit corporation and registered as a 501c3. So we could give, what do you call those things, receipts, tax receipts and tax allowances for this. And so I looked around then and thought, where should I start? I had worked in 13 different countries, and so I had some connections in all of them. I thought, in which country is the worst? Who is almost overwhelmed? And of course, the answer in terms of size and being overwhelmed, India is by miles ahead. The worst shape the world has seen. And so I thought, okay, so I'll start my experiment in India. So I went to Punjab, a state in the north, up against China and Pakistan, places like that. And I was welcomed warmly by the Secretary of Health, and he and his staff suggested a location where I should start, an area in which his health department had had total failure in terms of projects. And it was a big slum, between 19 and 20,000 residents, had been there a long, long time, and was unapproachable. They had made no progress. It was people were born there, died there, and nothing changed. And so I thought, that's lovely. That's exactly where I want to be, because if this idea works here, that's it. I've got a solution. So I did. And we set up the project there. And this harebrained thing went like this. I hired only Indian staff. And I hired, initially, two physicians, two nutritionists. These were young women with a master's in nutrition. One statistician, and then local field staff. So we sat down together and we drew a map of the slum with every house in the slum on the map. This hadn't been done before. We did this. And then we divided this into groups of houses that we call units. And each unit had approximately 280 households. And then in each unit, we hired one person. We didn't hire them by education or by anything, because there wasn't much education. The only requirement that these people had to fulfill was they had to be able to read and write. So we hired one person in each unit. We called this person a health promoter. So our first schedule was that each morning the health promoters would assemble in a rented quarters we had, and the senior staff would give the first hour a class in preventive medicine, and directed only at the nine diseases or infirmities that constituted better than 90% of the illness in our area. And then the second hour was on nutrition, and particularly on improving child nutrition. And then for the rest of the day, the other 5 hours, these people went back to their units and visited homes one after the other, passing on what they learned in the morning to these people. So this was our kickoff, and this we did. And after 2 years, we had an evaluation. And after 4 years, again, we had an evaluation. And the results of these evaluations were very, very encouraging. When we started, we surveyed conditions, health conditions, so we knew exactly what the rates were of illnesses, because we surveyed the houses 100%. It wasn't a sample survey, it was a 100% survey. And this survey showed us that the IMR, you all know what IMR is, don't you? Infant mortality rate. It's the number of babies who die before their first birthday for every 1,000 babies born. So when we started, the year before we started, 101 babies died before their first birthday for that 1,000 born. This is what, close to 10%? 1 in 10 babies died? That's pretty unacceptable. 4 years later, this had been reduced to 26. So that means like a quarter of what we had done before. And we had never done this with experts. We hadn't done it. The local people did it. The women who died in childbirth or because of childbirth similarly were reduced to about a quarter of the number in the year before we started. And a couple of years just gone by, 2016 was the first time in history that we know of that no woman died in childbirth for, or because of childbirth, for a calendar year. So we think We think we've got something. And the cost of this, it was less than $2 per beneficiary in the program per month. $2, $1.90-something. And so we are looking forward to having people being convinced that this is the way to go. And the implementers now are not so visible in the communities because they're not people in immaculate white coats. They're people in local attire. And this is a very significant symbol to us and sort of reflects a lesson that life has been trying to teach me this last 88 years, and that is it seems that the best person to solve a problem is the person who has the problem. Thank you.
I want to thank again our speakers and all our doctors of durability.